Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. Please, for a moment, imagine a weird sci-fi type music background. And then a voice comes on and talks about...
You're traveling. You'll soon be leaving the world of federal service and journeying into a land of challenges and wonders that lie ahead. Questions about this major transition span the depths of your concern about your future and can challenge the summit of knowledge of federal benefits and financial experts. There's a signpost up ahead. In the next hour, we will explore and explain some of the stranger issues that will face you in the retirement twilight zone.
Wow. And to...
Yay.
That was okay.
That was cool, Bob.
All right, Bob.
People think they have the wrong station.
All right. I'm sitting here and I feel like I'm at Mount Rushmore looking at the three faces of federal benefits. Between the three of them, there isn't anything that can be asked that can't be answered. Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, GovExec columnist, good friend, fellow seminar presenter. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, everyone. And nice to be here today.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. James Marshall, federal benefits whiz kid, right? And you're not retired military.
No. A decade in the military, but never did enough to actually get any money from it.
Okay, then he's as well a benefits presenter at the seminars. And Bob Bronstein, retired Fed. And seminar presenter and great voiceover.
Well, thank you, sir. My favorite show of yesteryear.
Okay, let's jump into it. Each one of these three fine people have done 10 different questions. If we did 30 questions, we'd be in here till tomorrow morning. We could do the drive-in show with this. But Tammy, you want to start off with your favorite
with
of the 10?
One of the 10. Okay, let's see. How about this one? A woman retired in June of 2011. In April of 2012, she received a letter from OPM saying that she owed the retirement fund more than $18,000. Why did she do this? You know, why did she owe all this money to the retirement fund, and why didn't she find out until almost a year after she retired? Does anybody have any idea of what happened in this case?
I'm guessing maybe some refunded service at some point. She might, probably had a break in federal service and maybe took some money out at one point. Maybe.
Why did it take so long?
There's definitely a backlog. There's people waiting for over a year just to find out how much they owe for these things. And so the retirement office at OPM is probably waiting for the deposit section at OPM to give them the answer to some, you know, how much they owe.
This is obviously a refunded period of service that ended after March 1st, 1991.
Actually, it was before 1982.
Really?
Yeah. What happened
was deposit service.
It was both. It was a deposit she owed for temporary service that wasn't covered by civil service contributions, and it was a refunded period of service that was before she took the refund before 10/1/82. So even though she owed $18,000 because of the interest that had accumulated, it only made a $200 a month difference in her retirement whether she paid it back or not.
Actuarial reduction.
So the good news was, even though she got this startling letter saying that she owed thousands of dollars to the retirement fund before her retirement claim would be finished, she really didn't have to pay it back in order to get almost all of her retirement. Very small reduction. So her choice was pay it and avoid the reduction, don't pay it and take a $200 a month reduction. I think her choice was to keep her money in the TSP and go on with life.
So Tammy, you basically just said that this young lady was waiting for 12 months for her annuity to be
almost
finalized, right?
Yep.
So the advice I give in classes is if you have any unpaid deposit or redeposit service, even if you don't plan on paying it, your best bet is to maybe just apply to make the payment. So that years before you retire, you can apply to make this deposit payment, even if you found out that it's not worth paying back. But at least you won't have to wait 12 months for your annuity to be finalized, because if they already have your information in their system, when the retirement office at OPM gets your application for retirement, it's a simple matter of contacting the people down the hall who do the computations. And instead of putting you in line to be computed, you're already in the system. They just spit out the new amount that you owe. So it might be adjudicated a little bit quicker if people would just apply to make their deposits.
And it would be less of a surprise if she would have inquired with her agency for a retirement estimate.
Absolutely. That's the question. Mm-hmm. How could anyone guard against it if they think they might, but they just don't remember?
Yeah, do a little homework while you're still getting a paycheck every 2 weeks.
Isn't there a general rule, too, that says if you owe deposits or redeposits and you're within a six-month window of retiring, that typically that's part of your retirement application? You don't submit separate applications for that?
That's right.
Yeah. That's what the because OPM knows it's going to take sometimes more than 6 months to get you the bill. But my point is, you know, when you get a retirement estimate, at least 5 years before you separate from the federal government. And then that's, you know, but before that, you can any employee can get a copy of their certified service history from their agency. And that's when they're often surprised and can discover, oh, I didn't know I had an unpaid deposit or redeposit. And that, you know, years before you retire, you can apply to make the deposit, get the bill. You can ignore the bill when it comes, but at least you're in the system.
All right, James, keep going. One of your 10.
One of my 10? Well, I had an interesting case yesterday, but I'll save that for another radio show. But one of my 10 that I had listed was the FERS annuity supplement that some folks, not everybody on the FERS, but some FERS employees, when they retire before their 62nd birthday and they're eligible for a full pension, you know, that includes, you know, someone who's reached their minimum retirement age at 30 or age 60 with 20, or some of our special group retirees, like the law enforcement officers, they're entitled to a supplement to their pension, which is more money than what their actual pension is. It's an additional amount of money. And the purpose of the supplement is to bridge the gap between the time that they're eligible for this pension under FERS and become eligible for Social Security at 62. And so sometimes just choosing what month to retire can net you several thousands of dollars of extra retirement income in the first 12 months or first 15, you know, first 24 months of your retirement. And I have some examples that I'd like to show where if you have a job lined up after you retire from FERS and you're eligible for the supplement, that your timing, what month to retire, could net you some extra retirement income.
And this is because the supplement may not be paid if you make too much money. It's subject to an earnings test the same way that Social Security is subject to an earnings test.
That's
so
right.
Initially you get it when you retire if you're entitled to it, but you might lose it.
Yeah, so even though it's the same earnings test that Social Security uses, OPM, their policy is they apply the earnings test slightly different from Social Security. Like Social Security won't give you any money if you're still working, you know, unless you're retired or unless you reach your full retirement age, which is going to be near, you know, somewhere between 65 and 67 years old. But OPM is nicer about it. They'll let you have the money first, and then they do an annual test. And they usually they call these letters surveys that OPM sends out to any FERS retiree who's receiving a supplement in addition to their pension. But these surveys are only sent out once a year, and the surveys are usually sent out in April. So if you retire, for example, in June of a given year, let's say June 30th, your pension starts
July 1st.
Starts on July 1st, payable on August 1st. So for the next 6 months, for the rest of 2013, you're going to get your supplement in addition to your pension.
Even if you're
no
working.
Matter how much money you're making, and between the date of your retirement and the rest of the year.
Because it has a Social Security tinge to it. I get a question. I don't do what you all do. I do tax and finance, but they think it's Social Security. And go, no, it comes from OPM, and you don't get the special tax treatment that Social Security would. And they all, no. And I go, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Social Security, I mean, if you had actually started a Social Security benefit and then went back to work, and as Tammy said, you wound up exceeding the earnings test to the point where you literally canceled out your benefit, they're going to get that money back from you. Mm-hmm. They're not nice about it at all. They'll pull it out of your wages. They'll pull it out of your taxes. So it's different. As James has aptly said, you start getting the supplement.
Even if you don't deserve it.
Right. You may wind up disqualifying yourself for it the following year, and they'll discontinue it, and then you have to reapply if your income drops to get some or all of it. But Social Security is a lot more severe about that.
But the other thing James is saying, it's a delayed reaction. So you'll get it for a while before you're subject to the survey, AKA earnings test.
That's right. So, I mean, you'll get it the year that you retire. Let's say you retire before December. You know, you're going to get it for all the months for the rest of this year. And you'll probably get them for the first, you'll still continue to get your supplement for the next 3 to 5 months, sometimes more. As a matter of fact, in 2012, it took them until October to stop giving people their supplements. So they got to keep 10 months worth of supplement in last year. So that's always going to be subject to change. OPM, depending on their staffing and how quickly they can get these surveys processed. But, you know,
and the earnings test, by the way, isn't that much. It's $15,120 for 2013. So if you're earning, if you go back to work after you retire and your earned income is more than $15,120, then for every $2 you earn above that limit, you lose a dollar of the supplement. So some of our retirees go back to work earning six-figure salaries, which means they'll eventually lose that supplement.
Within 3 months, you know, they've already earned more than the $15,000 limit.
And the other thing that surprises some people with the supplement is if you are in a special group like law enforcement, firefighter, you can get the supplement and go back to work and not be subject to the earnings test until you reach the FERS minimum retirement age, which is usually 56 or 57 years old. So some of those folks can collect it for 5 or 6 years before they lose it.
And the only exception for those folks would be those who kept working until their mandatory retirement age, probably. They wouldn't be collecting it very long.
That's right.
Okay, Bob, you're on.
All right, one of my favorite ones is actually a while back. This has to do with permanently disabled children. A permanently disabled child. I mean, you think in terms of a child who's disabled, continuing coverage under federal employees' health benefits as a family member as long as they're disabled. Usually, however, to continue that coverage requires a parent-child relationship. So if both the retiree is gone and, say, the survivor annuitant parent has also died, how can that disabled child maintain the health insurance? And the answer is if they were permanently disabled prior to the age of 18, they're eligible for a child survivor annuity benefit. And the child survivor annuity benefit enables them to keep the health insurance unless they recover from the disability or are subsequently married. Typically, it requires an annuity to be paid to someone in order to continue the health insurance. Yep. And 9 times out of 10, I mean, if the disability happens after the age of 18, then if the parents are gone, the child loses that coverage. So I found that to be amazing. I had a case like that in one of my classes.
Well, in a similar situation, if you have a child, just not handicapped child, just a dependent child who might still be in college or just doesn't have a job with benefits yet, and we know now that under healthcare reform, you can cover that child till they're 26. However, if both parents are deceased and the child is over 22 and no longer eligible for the children's survivor annuity, they'll lose their health insurance at 22, not 26.
That's that parent-child relationship again.
Yeah, that's why I think in most cases when someone passes away and there's multiple children involved, they usually put a family health insurance plan under the youngest child.
Right.
So that way so when the oldest child reaches the age of 22 and they no longer have a survivor benefit, they're still under the youngest child's FEHB plan.
Yeah, and the poor youngest child has to pay the price for all the other children.
They're the ones who've got to go find some other health insurance when they're 22.
That's right.
All righty. Now, listeners, it's your turn. 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. Give us a call. It's 10:18. It's March. Is today the 25th? 25th, 2013. We're Eastern time. We're on for about another 45 minutes. After that, don't call. We won't be here, but you can email us. We'll do the email in a little bit. Again, 202-465-3080. It's time for you to be able to ask any question that you couldn't get an answer to otherwise. All righty, Tammy, back to you.
Back to me. Okay. Let's look at my list of my top 10 of weird situations. Okay. I'll go with my first one I came up with. This one says, a military retiree lost 20 years of creditable service when he turned 62. That was over half of his retirement benefit. How did he lose 20 years of service when he turned 62? And let me give you a little background about this guy. He retired at, I think he was 57, under civil service retirement, and he was retired military. So he waived his military retired pay so he could use his 20 years of military service on top of his 18 years of civilian service that gave him 38 years to retire, I think 57. Well, when he turned 62, all of a sudden his retirement fell by more than 50%, and he panicked. In fact, he fought this in court and he lost. Why did he lose all that service?
Can I take a guess?
Sure.
Well, at 62, he had the required amount of credits for Social Security, and he never made deposit for that military time.
And the sad thing was, he also owed a redeposit because he had a break in service. And his agency, not to name who this was, but the agency advised him, which you should never do, but they advised him to pay the redeposit for the civilian service and not pay the military deposit.
Wow.
He took their advice.
Ooh.
And he went to court. He lost the appeal at the Merit Systems Protection Board. He went to the Court of Appeals, and the judge ruled in favor of OPM. So he still, to this day, does not get credit for those 20 years. And he's not alone. I found at least six other cases like this.
Yeah.
This is what we used to call Catch 62.
Yeah, and unfortunately, once you separate from federal service, you can't go back and pay the military deposits.
No.
You know, they have to be paid while you're working as a federal employee.
Was he able to reestablish his military retirement?
No. Once you waive your military retired pay, it's a permanent waiver. So he lost on both. It's the saddest story I know in my full career. And if there was anything I could do to fix that, I know Bob knows. I talk about this guy all the time. I wish I could help him, but there's nothing we could do because when he retired, he signed the waiver saying, I waive my right to pay my military deposit based on the information he got from his agency.
So for those who are out there, particularly CSRSers, you know, if you were hired CSRS before October 1, 1982, and you are in a situation where you're eligible for Social Security either at 62 or when you retire, if you have any military time is part of your benefit, you've got to make sure that you make deposit for it.
Really important. It's very valuable service.
Right.
And it's very confusing to a lot of people. I still run into people today who don't understand why or why not should they pay their military service deposit. And for that matter, even civilian deposits are very confusing. And I think what makes it so confusing is there's so many rules that go before this date, you do this. After that date, you do that. And if you're in the middle, you do something else. So it's a very confusing situation. And it also differs if it's civilian service or military service.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure you're making this decision based on good information.
Mm-hmm. James, your number six might have a really good broad-based application to our listeners. You want to give that a shot?
Yeah. My sixth point that I wanted to discuss today was in regards to those folks who are federal employees that are married to either federal employees or federal retirees. So we got a married couple that are both feds. And it has to do with, you know, who should have the health insurance coverage, you know, because in most cases, most feds, unless they're retired from the military, they tend to have federal employees' health benefits. It's a wonderful program for employees and retirees. But a lot of them get confused on what the requirements are. A lot of feds think that, well, I got to have my own plan for the last 5 years of my federal career in order to carry that coverage or keep that coverage when I retire. And the answer to that is really not true if you're married to a fed. As long as you're under the federal employees' health benefits program for the last 5 years of your federal career, even if the plan is under your husband or your wife's plan, you can always sign up for it later if something were to happen to your spouse, or if you decided your spouse wanted to get a different plan than you, you can get your own plan, as long as you were covered under the FEHB for the last 5 years.
Yeah, here's the situation I run across with that, James, is whenever you see a married couple who have kids, and usually about the time you retire is when that last child turns 26 and they bump off the federal health plan, so now it's just the husband and wife. Mm-hmm. And they decide to switch to two self-only plans, which can be cheaper in many cases than one family plan while they're working. So now the wife who just picked up her own coverage wants to retire next year. So when her agency looks to see that she has or doesn't have 5 years of coverage, it looks like she doesn't, because in her file, she just enrolled last year. So what she needs to tell them, or what they need to ask her, is were you covered under another federal health plan before you enrolled yourself? And she's going to say, yes, I was under my husband's federal health plan. Yep. Then we need a copy of his enrollment form to show OPM that you have 5 years.
Yeah, so
it can be an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I process many retirements where I just ask that employees, if you don't mind, go home tonight and ask your spouse to get a copy of the SF-2809 that shows that you were covered under that plan, you know, retroactive to however many years to meet the 5 year test. And that's all that's necessary. And it is an issue when she's covered at the time of retirement, but the issue doesn't occur if she's not covered. Let's say, for example, she's going to retire 5 years before he does. And then, you know, she knows that when she retires, her health insurance premiums will not be withheld on a pre-tax basis anymore. Mm-hmm. So even though two self-only plans tend to be slightly cheaper, we're talking about just a few dollars per pay period.
Depends on which plan.
Yeah, it depends on which plan. High-deductible plans may be different. But even though it's just a little bit of money each month that she's saving, if she keeps the self-only plan herself in retirement and he keeps the self-only plan as an employee, if the open season before she retires, she cancels hers and he enrolls her back into his, the money they'll save in taxes might be more beneficial than having two separate self-only plans.
It's always worth looking at both. And the other thing with two self-only plans, there could be differences in the out-of-pocket expenses between the deductibles, the catastrophic limits, and the coinsurance. So always look at the whole picture before you make that decision.
Absolutely.
Let me throw you a curve on that one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm under my wife's plan, and we're both retired. And
retired
the reason
feds.
I am is she's retired law enforcement, and she gets the tax break in retirement.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah, I wonder if all law enforcement know about that, Bob. I bet they don't.
Okay, it's been around for about 6 or 7 years.
And there's mass confusion with this. This is a provision called PSP. PSO, public safety officer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To be confused with another thing, but let's just do this.
Yeah.
So you've got a retired public safety officer, and they're having health insurance subtracted from their retirement pay. They're entitled to claim an additional tax subtraction on their return up to $3,000. So if their premiums were $2,500, they'd get $2,500. If they were $3,500, they'd get $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
But they have to be aware of this. This would be over and above what they get to subtract anyway to determine the taxable portion of their annuity. And it's actually pretty simple to do and odd how you present it. You just write PSO next to line 16B on the tax return. And, but you better be a retired public safety officer.
Right. And that's spelled out in what, publication 721?
721 is really the guiding force for any federal retirees' issues with regards
that's
to taxation.
IRS publication
721. IRS publication 721. Mm-hmm. Now, here's where it's sometimes confused with PSE, public safety employee. This is going to make your hair hurt. But this is not a Fed. But the feds think they qualify for this.
And that has to do with the TSP.
That's taking money out and not paying the penalty if you take it out early. And if you're a public safety employee, that's fine. But nobody listening to this show probably is a public safety employee because it's a non-Fed that this applies to.
And it mostly pertains to people who get a pension from that private, from that public employment, which the government and the TSP is not getting a pension. They're getting a monthly check out
exactly.
of their account balance.
Yeah.
So there's no exception for that.
Okay, Bob.
All right. I'll preface my next one with a little bit of information about how the percentage reimbursement for years of service that you have not only depends on retirement plans, but it also depends on occupational category. For example, law enforcement folks who were FERS for their first 20 years get 1.7% for each year times their high three as opposed to usually the 1%. Folks who work on the Hill also get a larger percentage reimbursement, but typically need 5 years of that service if they leave that organization for that extra multiplier to count. I came across a more unique situation. It has to do with a special type of overseas service that's typically served among intelligence agencies. The question was asked to me is that I have overseas service that's credited at 1.7% in my agency. DIA is where this individual works. If I leave that agency and subsequently retire from, say, Department of Agriculture, will that service percentage follow me and be counted when I actually retire from another organization? And I found out that, yes, it is portable. As a matter of fact, James and I went round and round on this, and we found a provision that said this service is locked in. It can be as little as a year, mm-hmm. and it follows you literally from place to place.
As long as it was performed after the law passed, which was it 89 or 87?
86.
Somewhere back in the late 80s.
And it's really unique, because typically a law enforcement person would need to go the full 20 years. If they bow out of that type of field after 10 years and do something else, they don't get the enhanced formula. Much the same way as a person in the legislative branch, if they don't get at least the five years and they go somewhere else, they don't either. But these
this
folks
is different. This is credited in 30-day increments.
Yeah,
so you could have 1/12th
really
of the year. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Could I ask a question? And I don't want to put anybody on the spot. Okay, public safety officers, they get special treatment, and they deserve it. But once they got something, military, for example, they got something in the tax law, and then the Foreign Service officer said, well, what about me? And then the public health officer said, well, what about me? And then the NOAA officer said, well, what about me? And the last one in the door is the intelligence community. So would the same provision apply to them that you mentioned? I mean, would they get the enhanced formula if they left? I speak a lot at State Department, and these are Foreign Service officers, and sometimes then they go to some other agency. So they had a period of time where they were Foreign Service officers, and then they go outside of Department of State.
That overseas time is under that same law.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, that overseas time is under the same law. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't necessarily, like as a Foreign Service officer, you get 20 years at 1.7%. But let's say you only spent 5 years at State Department, you moved to Commerce,
mm-hmm.
then only that 5 years would
that's
be computed if it was the qualifying service. It has to be the qualifying service.
Right.
So it does get confusing. And again, I'm sure that if I was a benefit specialist at an agency like Commerce, for instance, that may not have a lot of overseas employees, that I may not be familiar with that. And that's where we run into problems because you don't always know to check on those things. And if the employee doesn't bring it up for you to research it, you can miss it. So mm-hmm. always ask questions like that. The other thing I was going to say about the enhanced or the special groups is that under the new FERS-RAE, have y'all heard of FERS-RAE?
Yeah.
The revised annuity employee. Right. These are employees who are hired after December 31st of 2012. So these are employees who just came on board this year. Mm-hmm. They have to pay more towards the FERS basic retirement benefit, more towards their FERS pension. It's considerably more. They're contributing.
It's like more than three times as much.
It's like 3.2%.
They had an increase. What they did was Congress shifted the employer contribution to the employee, some of it.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that FERS-RAE employees are members of Congress and staff members in Congress, who those people who are elected or appointed after December 31st of 2012 no longer get the enhanced 1.7% for congressional service.
Mm, wow.
That ended.
Wow.
But it didn't affect anybody who was already a member of Congress when the law passed.
So not only do they pay more, but they get less.
They get less. Some of them will get less. Yeah. And some will get exactly the same as other FERS employees. What scares me about FERS-RAE is I think that's a targeted group now that we can say, okay, they're the ones who are going to get the high five or they're the ones who are going to lose the supplement.
Yeah.
So I think that they can be focused on as a separate entity from FERS or CSRS.
I'd like to take just a brief moment to teach some people who are listening how to avoid being a FERS-RAE. You know, first of all, if you've already got 5 years of FERS service, you'll never be a FERS-RAE unless they change the law again.
Yeah.
But if you have less than 5 years of FERS service now, and you've already been grandfathered in if you began your federal career before January 1st of this year.
Yeah.
But if you leave before you get 5 years of service, if we rehire you later, you're going to come back under FERS-RAE. So my suggestion is get your 5 years of service before
you
leave the federal government.
Yeah.
Period.
It's probably a good idea anyway,
period.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it takes 5 years
to
be vested.
When we call vested, that means 5 years of civilian service.
Yeah.
So I would always try to say stick it out the first 5 years and you've got something to show for it.
Yeah, but you can imagine how hard it would be for a 23-year-old who's getting paid $25,000 a year and has a private sector job offer of $50,000 a year to, you know, not take it. But you just got to realize what you're giving up if you leave before you get your 5 years of service.
Let me mention one more thing, too, just not to beat a dead horse to death. But typically, one of the things I always tell folks who are FERS versus CSRS is that, yes, you're getting a benefit that's about half the size of CSRS, but you've been paying 1/8 the cost.
Right.
I think what this has done is it hasn't quite equalized. I mean, if the CSRS folks are paying 7% for the benefit, now you got FERS-RAE people paying, what, 3.1%?
Mm-hmm.
So they're still a little bit under when you think in terms of what they're paying for this, quote, defined benefit, what a CSRS person
is
paying.
When FERS was implemented back in the 80s, I remember hearing this said, I think it was somebody up on the Hill, said that the idea of the contribution that employees would pay towards FERS was to make it so that they would pay no more than a CSRS employee would pay into CSRS. So when you add the FICA tax plus the FERS contribution, you come up with 7%.
Exactly. And then
so,
they get the they also get Social Security for the same
exactly.
service.
Exactly. So now the FERS-RAE employees actually are paying more
That's
required
true.
Contributions out of pocket.
Yeah. And so supposedly when
thrift.
You combine their FERS retirement income with their Social Security income, it should be somewhat equivalent to what someone CSRS gets.
In many cases, it is.
Yeah.
In many cases, it is.
Without anything else. Yeah.
I think what people have to realize about FERS, and especially taking the Social Security piece of it, is that it's a tilted system where somebody who works their career at a low salary is going to get a more generous replacement of Social Security,
right.
meaning they don't have to save quite as much in a thrift.
Mm-hmm.
Where someone who's a GS-15 their whole career, they better be putting money in the thrift plan or they're going to come out behind.
True,
yeah,
true.
Most of
unless
their
they
Social
want to work till they're 70.
Comes in at 15% because their income is so much higher,
that's 15 right.
and 32% levels.
That's right.
Yeah.
So once you get that concept down, FERS makes it a lot easier to understand.
Okay, keep rolling, Tammy.
Okay, we're back to me. Okay, Tammy, where's my questions? Here they are. Okay, here we go. CSRS retiree retired and elected full survivor benefits for his wife. So when he retired, he had been married to the same woman for his entire 35-year career, so he elected for her to get the full benefit. After retirement, unfortunately, the couple divorced. It was within 2 years of their retirement they went through a divorce. So when they went to court to settle the divorce, she was awarded half of his retirement. Well, this poor guy, a year later, he dies. What does she get now?
Well, unless the divorce decree said anything about a survivor benefit,
right.
she doesn't get anything.
You're exactly. right. She gets nothing.
Yeah, nothing.
And she didn't
over.
Know that. She thought that because her, at the time, husband elected full survivor benefits, that that would just continue after the divorce.
Mm-mm.
What she didn't know was that as the date the divorce was final, that election he made was void. In order for her to get survivor benefits, that had to be specifically spelled out in the divorce decree, and unfortunately it wasn't.
Usually when it is spelled out in the decree, it's incumbent upon the retiree to provide a copy of that court order when they retire.
Yeah, but I think it was just a misunderstanding that she just assumed where she shouldn't have assumed. Well, and maybe even the lawyer did.
In her case, since it wasn't mentioned, it was incumbent upon her attorney to file that with OPM, which I'm sure they did. But it's interesting. On the application itself, it says if there's any mention of a survivor benefit in the decree, you have to put it in there, right?
Right.
But in this situation, it looks like she divorced after they retired.
No, I understand. Mm-hmm. I understand, right. And so there was no mention of it at all.
Nope. It was just a big misunderstanding, which, she was suing the government to say that, she thought she was entitled to it. And the judge said, I'm sorry, but, this is the law. And the funny thing is, it says that in the instructions on the retirement application. But of course, once you retire, what do we do with those instructions? Toss them.
Yep.
But what I always tell my classes is if you have a life-changing event, you get diagnosed with a terminal illness, you go through a divorce, you get married, pull those applications back off the internet or pull them out of the trash can and take a look and see what you can change when you have a situation like that. Because even though we call these permanent elections, you can change things. Mm-hmm. Especially if it's soon after you retire, you can certainly make some changes. There might be a penalty, but it could be well worth it.
Does it then say, this is an uninformed question, by the way. Mm-hmm. I'm staring at Mount Rushmore here in awe. Does it make sense always to have 1% survivor's annuity?
Well, if your spouse is not a federal employee or not going to be a federal retiree, and you want to make sure that your spouse can stay under FEHB, the federal health insurance plan, then you've got to leave at least a partial survivor benefit in order for them to continue coverage should you die first. That's considering you're still married, let alone getting divorced. So that's why some people who have a spouse who don't really need the money, they might have enough retirement of their own, they'll still leave their spouse, and under civil service, it can be a very small amount. They'll still leave them at least a partial survivor benefit so that in the event they die first, that surviving non-federal spouse can stay under FEHB as long as that annuitant died in a family plan. In other words, the surviving spouse can't enroll themselves if they only had self-only coverage. Mm-hmm.
So. On the first side, it's literally you have to elect a survivor benefit that's equivalent to half of the maximum. You don't have as much granularity as you do in CSRs.
Yeah, FERS has two options. But civil service, it's 55% of something. Mm-hmm. And I have seen people put in there 55% of $22.
Which, after taxes, is a dollar a month.
A dollar a month.
It's a nickel a month out of your retirement check, I think.
That's right.
All right, listeners.
I always say leave enough to pay the health insurance.
I'm feeling very lonely in here. I need some help with questions. 202-465-30. 202-465-3080.
Unfortunately, it didn't snow enough, so the employees had to go to work today. So they can't call from work. I guess that's why we're not getting calls.
Okay. For you all in California, I know one guy in California is listening to us, and we're going to answer one of his questions in a little bit. But James, fire away.
Well, my items 2 and 3 are kind of related to what you guys have been talking about, so... as far as health insurance is concerned, a FERS employee, if they've got their spouse or their family, or let's just say their spouse covered under their federal employees' health benefits plan, as long as they have 18 months of service under their belt, even if they're not vested under FERS yet, as long as they have 18 months of FERS service under their belt and they're in a family plan, and if they were to pass away, that allows the surviving family member, the spouse, for example, to keep that FEHB coverage at the same rate where the government helps them pay for that health insurance. So that's just briefly one thing I wanted to mention.
Right. Yeah, the vesting for survivor benefits is less if it's an employee who dies.
That's right. Now, the danger, though, is what I have listed for item number 3. Okay. There are many feds who don't become feds until later in their careers, like maybe in their late 50s, even in their 60s. They finish doing something in the private sector and then they become a fed. They have something to offer. There are many federal employees who are 62 years old who have 5 years of service.
Or 2 years of service.
Or they got 5 years of service, for example. They can retire any day they want, but they have less than 10 years of service. If they were to die as a federal employee with less than 10 years of service, even though they have enough to qualify for a retirement, if they die as an employee, there would be no survivor benefit.
Just the lump sum payment. Just the basic employee death benefit.
Okay, we have a caller.
Oh, we got someone talked into
calling. Good morning.
Good morning. I have two quick questions. One to follow up on what you're talking about right now regarding the health benefit plans. I'm a federal employee and have been covered beyond 5 years. If I retire and get married, is there a means for me to sign up my spouse under the FEHB.
Absolutely. That's considered a qualifying life event. And I think it's 60 days either side of the marriage. You should be able to enroll your spouse outside of an open season. Just fill out the same standard form 2809 indicating, showing proof of the marriage. And there would be no problem. You'd be able to do that at any time, even if you're retired.
Yep. And you can even elect a survivor benefit for your new spouse after retirement. You have 2 years from the date of marriage, almost like a 2-year test drive. Make sure it's going to work out before you make that election.
Bob, where do you get that form?
You can download it.
Off opm.gov.
opm.gov/forms.
And it's 2809.
Standard form 2809. Remember, too, though, that if you are retired and you are electing a survivor benefit so that your, say, your spouse who is not a federal employee can keep that coverage if you predecease him, that the payment for the survivor benefit is retroactive to the date you retired. So there's going to be some money that you would owe OPM that would be otherwise actuarially reduced from your annuity at that point.
And they give you that calculation before you have to make the election. So you'll get that information as soon as you would contact OPM.
And earlier you were talking about the OPM's earnings test for the supplement. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bit confused about what you were saying regarding the time of year to retire. It seems to me that the year that you retire, you wouldn't be eligible for the supplement because your earnings would be higher unless you retired very early in the year. Am I understanding this correctly?
Well, we didn't go into too many details, but that's a great question. The earnings that you make as a federal employee before you separate from federal service will not be used against you that first year's earnings test. It's only the work income, the job that you have lined up after you retire that'll affect it. So that's what we're thinking, that maybe if I got a nice $50,000 or $100,000 a year job lined up after I retire, instead of retiring on June 30th, just change my date of retirement back out to October. So that way I don't have time between November and December to make $15,000 of post-retirement income and collect my supplement a little bit longer, maybe for a whole another 8 or 9 months longer. And if my supplement's $1,000 a month, that's an extra $8,000 or $9,000 of extra retirement income just by changing what month to retire.
Perfect. Right. Thank you so much.
Yep, you're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right, great.
Bye-bye.
Actually, we had an email yesterday knowing that you all would be on, and here's the question. I heard that in early outs, there is no reduction in FERS benefits. I'm 50 years old, and I am eligible to receive $1,600 a month, but at 57, I will be eligible for $2,200 a month if I continue to work. Will I be eligible for the full $2,200 if I leave now?
No.
Not at all.
No. What we mean when we say that there's no reduction under FERS for an early out, it means that the $1,600 benefit that's based on this writer's length of service, salary, and the 1% calculation would not be reduced because the employee's under their minimum retirement age. So they would still get the FERS benefit that they're entitled to based on their current service and salary. And they would also get the supplement, but it would not be payable until they reach the minimum retirement age, which may not be for this person until age 56.
Okay, a follow-up question the gentleman had as well. If I leave the government at 55, will I still have a 10% penalty from distributions from the TSP?
The answer is no.
The answer is no, but you will from your IRA. Mm-hmm. And we have another caller.
Oh, wow. Good.
Nice. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Well, everything's good now that you're on the phone.
Thanks. I have a question regarding, you were talking about disabled children continuing to get the benefits from their retired federal parents. How does the definition of disabled work in that situation? Do they have to be receiving SSI?
Well, typically, according to the OPM definition, a permanently disabled child with disability beginning before the age of 18 is permanently eligible for what's called the child survivor annuity benefit. And as long as one person is receiving an annuity, whether it's a parent, say the retiree, or the surviving parent who is a survivor annuitant, that child is covered under the health insurance. Typically what happens, though, if they don't meet that definition, when the parent-child relationship ends, say the parents are gone, then the health insurance would lapse. But this child would be permanently able to get the child survivor benefit unless they married or recovered from the disability for life. So that would enable them to keep the health insurance as well, since they would be the recipient of a survivor annuity even when their parents were gone.
And there's no requirement. OPM doesn't have a requirement that the child be entitled to any Social Security benefit. Right, it's right. mainly based on the fact that they were disabled as a child and they remain incapable of self-support and are unmarried.
And that began prior to the age of 18.
Okay. I guess I need to research a little more on my end, too, is that how they actually define permanently disabled. My daughter has cerebral palsy, and she's still young enough now that we don't know exactly how much.
How old is she now?
She's 9 right now.
Yeah. You don't have to worry about this until she would get to the point where she would lose her health insurance coverage. And then you would declare, you know, at that point, if she's not able to work and support herself independently, then if you're still employed, you would do it through your agency. And if you're retired, you would contact OPM to get her certified as disabled.
Okay. All right. Great. That's good to know. Thanks
okay.
so much.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. One last part from the emailer. And thanks for calling.
Yeah.
All righty.
Love phone calls.
finally, how many months should I save since it takes a while for OPM to pay me my full annuity, and should I dip into the TSP to make up the difference? Now, remember, this is the one leaving at 55.
50. Oh, 55.
Well, it depends on which email. It was 50 and one, and I think he's 55 in this one. So he's 55 and leaving. Isn't there that supplement thing that gets paid?
Not until minimum retirement age.
Okay.
So it's either 56 or somewhere between 56 and 57.
Okay. So we've got a gap for a while. So then the question that he asked, that gap or any other gap, should I take money out of the TSP? That is the last place you should go.
Yeah. Yeah,
I agree.
And it's easy for me to say there may not be any other place to go. Mm-hmm. But that would be the last place I'd go.
I would wait till the dust settles and see if you're going to take on a part-time job or you take on secondary employment, because that could very easily make up the loss of income that you need rather than to start, you know, taking from your investments that might have to last another 40 years.
Yeah, it appears that this question, it seems to me that he's asking, you know, that, you know, I got bills to pay and, you know, I've heard horror stories of how long it might take for me to get my first retirement check. So how much months worth of money do I need to save up? And I always tell people, if you can plan ahead, you know, try to have about 6 months worth of money saved up to be able to afford to pay your bills. But not everybody has that opportunity to do that. So maybe another thing is to, instead of retiring in the spring or summer, be conservative with your vacation, save up your annual leave, and retire at the end of the year so you can use that money.
Lump
save
sum
up
annual
450
leave.
Hours of leave between what you carry over and what you can earn. So
absolutely.
That gets paid out within 2 to 4 weeks, and in most cases, you know, 1 to 2 pay periods after you leave the federal government.
TSP is very expensive money, because if you take a dollar out, you're not getting a dollar. You're paying federal and probably state taxes.
Sure.
So in a minimum, you're probably seeing 20% of it go away and maybe 33%. That's, and plus you're taking money out. I use the analogy, you're pulling a log out of a fire that's blazing. And
plus he's got
that,
another 40 years of life ahead of him. Yeah. That, you know, he needs to let that money grow a little bit longer.
You know, the other thing to consider too, once OPM gets through this backlog, and I realize there was a spike in retirements in February beyond what they originally anticipated. I mean, the typical adjudication process, or at least it was when I retired, is about 3 months where you're getting 75 to 80% of your benefit. Then they catch you up with what they owe you and your whole from that point forward. And assuming they continue to make inroads into this backlog, which should, you know, get them down pretty far to almost normal maybe by the end of this year, I don't think this concern is going to last too much longer.
And for many employees, the amount they get in the interim checks is very close, surprisingly close, to what their net annuity is going to be anyway, with the exception of not getting the supplement during that time.
Right.
And I think it does surprise some employees when they do get their final payment to say, oh, this is it, because it is less than your paycheck. It's you have to get used to a fixed income, as they say, when you're retired. And for some employees who are retiring with just 30 years of service, although we consider 30 years to be a full career, that's still 56% of your high three under civil service and 30% under FERS plus the supplement.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be prepared for that.
Yep.
Okay, listeners, we've got two. We need three more to break the record. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Bob, you're up.
Okay, let's shift gears for a second. I have one in here that has to do with Social Security. I found this to be kind of interesting, and I actually reached out to Tammy and James for some additional advice on this one, too. If you go through the Social Security website, it's replete with information about, you know, when you're eligible for a benefit, if your retirement benefit is higher than a benefit you could otherwise get based on a spouse's work income, then they're going to give you yours first. That's usually the case, but there's an exception. And the exception occurs if you're at full retirement age. Say you and your spouse are both at full retirement age, and you're looking perhaps to suspend your benefit to age 70 so you can gain the additional horsepower of what we call delayed retirement credits. In this situation, one of the spouses at full retirement age would actually be able to draw on a spouse's record, even if his or hers is higher. One spouse files and suspends benefits until 70. The other spouse files a restricted application for the spouse benefit, even if it's lower than their own. That way, one of the two gets some benefit from Social Security on their road to age 70, and then at 70, the person who's drawing the spouse benefit switches to his or her own, which is higher, and the other individual starts drawing the suspended benefit. I mean, the strategy here is it's not without its risks. I mean, clearly, if you live long enough, you're going to get a bigger entitlement from Social Security. You know, we have an example in our workbook, a couple doing this who lives to be 85 and winds up getting another $91,000 of Social Security benefits. But you've got to live, and there are other considerations.
If we only knew the end date, we'd know exactly when
exactly
to take Social
right.
Security.
But even when you don't know the end date, I ran across a couple. This was different from what I was talking before class, but I mean before the radio show. But a few weeks ago, I ran across a couple. They were both planning on waiting until 70 to collect Social Security, and they're both the same age. Mm-hmm. They're both planning on waiting to collect maybe 124 to 132% of their benefit. They've already decided that was best for them. I said, well, one of you could, if you wanted to, collect half for the other.
He's saying.
And do exactly what Bob said and collect something while
you're waiting.
It doesn't hurt what you were planning on doing anyways.
That's so. Right.
Credit where credit is due. This was James. He and I had this conversation. He told me about this. So, you know, I sort of jumped the gun and I gave the information that you gave me. So thank you.
Yeah, it's good stuff, though.
That's what they call Social Security strategies.
That's right.
Yeah.
You've got to live long enough
to get them.
Yeah.
As, in the words of one of my favorite actors, do you feel lucky?
All righty, Tammy, with that.
With that, we'll go back to my list. Okay, my list says this. All right. How about this one? An 80-year-old man elected no reduction of his Fegley life insurance. Why would he be willing to pay $194 a month to maintain $100,000 worth of life insurance? That should be kind of obvious, because sometimes we run into federal employees who work later in life. You know, they work until they're in their 70s, until they don't want to work anymore. And sometimes that's a lot later than the average employee's retirement date. So here he is during the time of his career, paying 15 cents per thousand biweekly for basic Fegley life insurance, which I don't know any 80-year-old that's going to get that kind of price on life insurance. Mm-hmm. So the day he retires, if he doesn't elect no reduction, his life insurance is going to immediately start to reduce to 25% of its value. In other words, $100,000 would start reducing down to $25,000. But if he pays this premium, if it would cost him $194 a month to maintain that full $100,000 benefit. If he lives out his normal life expectancy of maybe another up to 10 years, let's say, he would have paid $194 a month times 12 months. That's about $2,400 a year times 10 years. That's 1/4 of the value of that policy that's going to go to his beneficiary totally tax-free.
That's right. Where else can he make an investment and give somebody a return? He doesn't get the return on it. No. Someone else will. But where else can he deposit that kind of money?
Member,
and give
it could be a charity. Absolutely. It could be anything. But it's a nice legacy to leave behind for someone who works that long in life.
Sure. Okay. Could I ask a question? Let's look at mid to beginning career side of life in Fegley. Do you talk in class? I know we don't sell anything, but if you were to say, okay, Fegley's going to cost me X, could I go on the outside and get it for less than X?
Yeah, there's two things. And what I was talking about in my example was somebody who just had basic Fegley, which all federal employees are enrolled in as soon as they're hired. And I usually don't recommend dropping that because there's some real good reasons to keep basic life. But I think what you're referring to, Bob Lyons, not Bob Bronstein, is that some employees and a lot of employees sign up for optional Fegley. And the one popular option is option B, where you can elect multiples of your salary. And that option B coverage starts off real innocent. Like when you're 22 years old, it's 2 cents per thousand biweekly, you know, the big deal. And your salary might be a GS-7, so it's not breaking the bank. But as you turn 49 to 50 or 54 to 55, now you're paying, you know, 13 cents per thousand or 23 cents per thousand. It's becoming a very noticeable withholding from your paycheck. And this is the age when a lot of employees think about dropping that optional coverage and buying a term policy, which if you can qualify, you can still beat the price. Mm-hmm. But I think what you're saying is even at a younger age, knowing that that's going to happen and you know what your needs are for life insurance based on if you have kids, if you bought a house, you know, what are your responsibilities that you're leaving behind, that maybe it'd be worth it to go out and buy some cheaper life insurance from day one and supplement your basic life with an outside policy. Two things I'll say to that. Number one, are you insurable? Because if you're not, it's not an option. Yep. And number two, how are you going to die? And I know we don't know that, mm-hmm. but let's say that you work in a job where it's going to take you overseas to dangerous parts of the world, and it could be an act of terrorism, an act of war. You could work in Washington, D.C. and have that happen. So if you think that, you know, this private policy might have a clause that says we don't cover an act of war and act of terrorism, then be leery of that policy. Mm-hmm. So make sure you get a policy that's going to cover you just like Fegley, regardless of how you die. It'll pay the death benefit. And Fegley really has, the only exception Fegley has is if your beneficiary intentionally caused your death, they won't pay. But otherwise, they'll pay for suicide, they'll pay for war, they'll pay for terrorism, they'll pay for a race car driving accident, they don't care how you die. Fegley pays pretty much no matter what.
What you say really makes sense. I always tell people that insurability or insurance is, you need to take the temperature of that throughout your career. It's your life's is going to change. Your kids are going to launch. You're going to pay down the mortgage. Perhaps your need for insurance as you get to retirement is less, and you can just simply start dropping some of it.
Andrew, the engineer, is captivated by the show, but he says we got about a minute and a half. So, James, fire away.
Oh, wow, a minute and a half, right?
Well, you don't even have a minute and a half.
Forget James. He can't cover it in a minute and a half.
Well, there's nothing I can cover in a minute and a half.
But let me say one thing there that add on to what Bob Bronstein said about the need reducing for life insurance as you get older and as your responsibilities start to drop away. That's true. And I think when we get this question in class about, do I need long-term care insurance or how can I afford to pay for long-term, if I got life insurance and Medicare and health insurance, you know, I can't possibly afford another insurance. But if you can reduce your life insurance and save $200 biweekly, that frees up some money to buy long-term care.
Absolutely. All right.
Okay, we got less than a minute. Thanks for you all listening. Listen every week. It's NITP, and we're happy to present this to you. Tammy, James, Bob, I've been doing this 7 years, I think, and this is just really watching you all spin.
Fun.
Oh, yeah, this is fun.
Great.
Thanks
for
listening. Thanks for you all coming in. Listen next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.